Welcome to a breakthrough in wellness. LifeWave X39 patches are proud sponsor today. Imagine tapping into ancient healing through modern technology. The X39 uses light photon therapy, which is a practice that actually dates back 2,000 years to energize your body's natural flow and to produce stem cells. It's not just wellness, it's science actually enhancing your life. These patches empower your own body to produce its own stem cells, which revitalize you from within. Feel the surge of youth and wellness almost immediately. And with your LifeWave X39, your satisfaction is guaranteed. 100% money back. No risks, just pure wellness. So if you sign up as a preferred customer plus, today you'll get it for $19.95 a month. You'll receive wholesale prices, subscription savings, loyalty rewards, sample products of all the different patches, and your own referral link. So this Christmas, you guys, everybody was sick around me. We were in Portland at my family's and literally everybody got sick. I had the patches on and I stayed completely healthy. And it was all thanks to X39. And then when I found out that I could put the patches on children, I put one on 7 because she was also really sick. And she had had a fever, but I put the patch on and she was back to normal, no fever, in just 2 hours. And me, I'm feeling like I'm 21 years old again. I have so much energy, it's crazy. So if you're ready to join as a provider, you're going to go and you're going to click join and then just select your package. And then don't forget to add the Preferred Plus program for all the exclusive benefits I just told you about before for $19.99. And this will be available for the next month. Okay, so you want to visit www.lifewave.com, LIFEWAVE.com/psychicbabes, PSYCHICBABES, to start your journey to renewed energy and wellness. LifeWave X39, energize your life, guys. You won't regret it.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff.
We're in the 21st century. Humans that aren't awake survive in a self-made penitentiary. If you're seeking truth, honesty, integrity, stay away from the polarity. There's only one place to turn to. You can't trust the singularity. I'll be that babe, spreading higher consciousness, wisdom, because we ain't no one's test subject, and we ain't no damn victim. Wake up, humanity, before it's too late. If you sit where I'm sitting, we got a checkmate. Question everything, fairy rings, aliens, reptilians, Arcturians, Palladians, dragons, and even our own origins. Psychic babes, we empower humankind. Seek the truth, but don't seek through the mind. This is how we win, go within, stand together. Colors can't divide us, watch our differences unite us.
Welcome to Psychic Babes. Today we are doing something new. If it works out, I have my good friend Shay Fulford with me today. She has many gifts of her own, and we're looking to possibly have her co-host on this show. So she's going to be joining us. And today we also have Michael Norse. He's trained in 4 lineages of Vedic astrology, a yogic science out of India, and he basically deconstructed the entire system in order to ground it in modern day physics, physiology, and psychology for the Western scientific mind to possibly comprehend. In that process, confirmed by his gurus, he recovered the original yogic science far more associated with Kriya Yoga and Ayurveda, the Indian science of health and life. He views this science as an elegant yet approachable form of macrobiology that recognizes our indigenous relationship with the biosphere Earth that is forever governing our mortal lives. He understands that all psychology is a product of neurology and physiology meeting environment to create a complex narrative that we call ourselves. Planetary placements at the moment of our first breath connect us to a form of data points that then engineer possibilities as life choices for us to determine our identities and directions against fixed context of history, gender, circumstances, and skills. He calls himself a clock watcher and likes to say he works for time. He's a devoted meditator with an artful heart and an international client base that he adores. And I will put the link to where you can reach him for appointments. And he prefers to consult for humans who understand fully that our personal choices in the present create futures of our lives. So welcome, Michael. I love that intro.
That's very nice to meet you. I'm sorry for the long bio there. My goodness. But actually, I was listening back to it. I thought, oh, it's not so bad. That's kind of exactly how I think about it.
No, I love it. So you and I, we've talked a little bit in the past, but and you're going to, I'm so excited for you to do Trent and Mine's reading in next month. So tell us a little bit about your story, who you studied with, and kind of how you decided to focus your life's work on Vedic astrology.
It's so interesting. I appreciate the question. I really like tripped and fell into it. I feel like it kind of grabbed me by the throat like a Rottweiler and threw me into it more than anything else. I've been a meditator most of my life. My first root guru was a Dzogchen master named Chogyal Namkhai Norbu, extraordinary genius. And I worked with him and Dzogchen for 20 years. And so I really was in the Tibetan world for a very, very long time. Buddhism in general is really speaks to me quite a lot. And Tibetan Buddhism is fascinating. I like to say that they are the smartest colonialists in the world, actually, because they conquer through the heart, really.
Yeah.
You know, but they certainly have some big, big, big communities all over the West now as a result of their intelligence and their communicating empathy and compassion. So it's pretty easy to fall into that camp for a young, troubled guy who was looking for answers in his life. But strangely enough, I was working in Hollywood as a screenwriter, TV writer, actually, and I was with a producer who was super frustrated with me. He wanted to do a broadcast network show, and I wanted a dark cable drama. And he decided before he was going to waste any more time with me that he was going to send me to his astrologist. And I thought, oh God, only in Hollywood, right? and he said, oh, he said, don't be like that. He's a Hindu astrologer. And I thought, oh, I don't even know what that means. But I show up to Chakrapani Ulal's office in Hancock Park many years ago, and he read my chart like it was a book. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like it. And he really only got one thing wrong, which even he and I were surprised about. Later on, looking at re-listening to the reading and looking at my chart, I see how he missed it. And we both chuckled over it. But during the reading, at one point, I was so shocked. I said to him, how are you doing this? Because I'd had, you know, different kinds of intuitive readings, but this was far more precise. I mean, he literally told me that I had a library at home that was unusually ordered. I mean, this is literally what he said to me.
Just from your chart.
Just from my chart. And the truth is, my book collection is one of my prized possessions, or certainly was at the time. And it is actually chronologically organized. So I start with the first literary creations in history and go all the way to present day. And it just makes life a lot more easy in terms of understanding that Herman Melville was writing in the same period that, say, you know, Chekhov was writing and these kinds of things. It just puts a lot of context into your world. So I was just fascinated. I said, how are you doing this? And he said, he just looked at me and he said, it is a science. And I said, well, if it is a science, like, then I could learn it. And that was the first moment that he really got kind of interested in me, I think. And I wasn't just a client. And he looked over his glasses at me and he said, do you want to learn? And I said, I don't know. How good a chart is it for an astrologist? And he said to me, it is a very good chart. And somewhere in the mix of all of it, we just kind of fell in deep appreciation. And I would go back on a consistent basis to have sessions with him. And he basically taught me on my chart. He gave me an enormous amount of his secrets, a lot of like little kind of back channels to really think about in context. And I definitely consider him my root guru in the system. Weirdly enough, at the same time, as you're leaning in for Indian astrology, my Tibetan practice began to collapse for multiple different reasons. And I found myself very quickly after that studying Kriya Yoga. And that just went off the Richter scale. I first began to study with Siddhanath, Yogi Raj Siddhanath, and worked with him for almost 11 years. And then And then he and I agreed, and he's graduated me to a friend of his who I really, I don't know if it's graduation, but we're very good friends still. And he has sent me to his friend, my Gurudev now, who's Shailendra Sharma. And in the process of all of this, I deconstructed the Vedic system. And I deconstructed it because, in all honesty, as I said to Chakrapani and to Yogi Raj, like, realistically, if I can't explain how it works, then it's just dogma. And I don't want to be engineering more dogma out in the world. I think there's plenty of dogma out in the world, and I just didn't want to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. So it took me a long time to deconstruct it, as both of them warned me. But I feel like I really understand it from a very scientific point of view, and look at it from a very scientific point of view.
Now, do you teach other people the ways that you've had? You taken on students yet?
Well, the good news is I'm in process. I was very blessed to have a really, really extraordinary documentary filmmaker show up in my life, and she came for a session and then came back a week later, and I was like, no, you don't need to see me again. She goes, yes, I do. Please, like, get me in. And so I got her in. She showed back up with a spiral of questions that had nothing to do with her personal life, because she's just such an extraordinary human being that cares about other people. And she just had all these questions about, you know, for the modern world, really, and how do we fix this? And it was one of the most interesting sessions. She's one of the most extraordinary questioners I've ever met. And we are just in process of editing a podcast where we're teaching the basics of it. Because my goal is to basically, if I can teach humanity what the Indians already know, that we live on a very, very complicated, but also very simple and elegant clock. And that our biosphere is one, the Earth is one of the cogs in that system, spinning around in relationship with its brother or sister planets, however you want to look at them, inside of this neurological circuitry that is a solar system, really. And that solar system is having a conversation with our neurological system, which is arguably the most advanced species on the planet, even though a lot of times we don't behave like that. What I like to point out is, you know, people love to say, well, I think, you know, dolphins and whales are smarter than us, and they may be. But the difference is you're not going to go to a dolphin church. You know, you're not going to go listen to a whale rock band, realistically. Like, what I think Michelangelo got so beautifully right about the species is God is reaching out and humanity as Adam is reaching back. Do I wish Eve were in that conversation? Yes. But that's just part of the contextualized misogyny that was a part of Western civilization as it was developing into European colonialism.
Now, something else that you do, which is I haven't heard of before, which is you channel the planets. How did that come into play, and when did that start?
I mean, I just really have to. I don't like saying that. I mean, I will admit it when my arm is twisted behind my back. It's not so much that. It's just that they are living entities to me, in the sense of really just being these extraordinary bodies. Mm-hmm. And as a result of what they do in the conversation of this vast macrobiology that we're living inside of, there is an interdependent connectivity that I think makes it very easy to anthropomorphize them and to really experience them in their functionality, particularly in our own systems, as something that is very legitimate. And when you see Venus, like, you know, dropping on the horizon at night or in the morning, where it is right now, actually tightly conjunct Mars, you know, seeing the red planet there and seeing this bright, looks like a mothership in the morning, it's really impossible not to just be in awe, even though we know that these are planetary bodies that are reflecting sunlight back down to us. There has to be more to it, certainly in the conversation of how our system is composed, because I believe if one of these planets were moved even, you know, maybe a mile off of their vector, it would change every piece of life that we understand in this solar system, particularly on the Earth. You know, it's the one thing that I worry the most about is an asteroid hitting the moon. you know, not worry per se, but I think that it, the moon is a very sophisticated calibration mechanism. It controls cycles and water down here. It has a lot more to do with than just emotions as it's been engineered, you know, throughout history. Though I think that they get a lot of that right because water and emotions are very, very similar in context. And, you know, as someone who has read for doctors and has had them personally tell me how crazy the ERs get on full moons, I mean, there's some legitimacy to this. And farmers also plant alongside that those vectors really where they're thinking about the relationship of the moon when they plant seeds in context. And I have good farmer friends up in upstate New York who get some of the most extraordinary crops because they grow on the principles of the Farmer's Almanac, which is a moon cycle almanac, and also some of the principles of Rudolf Steiner in the anthroposophical community.
Yeah, no, I can definitely testify to that, that the moon is a very powerful energy, and especially when it's a full moon. For me, it's kind of like I use that energy a lot, and I'm able to, I have more, you know, instead of being more emotional stuff like that's more like I have more energy when there's a full moon. So
yeah, absolutely. And that will be visible in your chart. Realistically, you know, people who have a strong connection to the moon tend to have a lot going on with the moon in their chart. They're very, very deeply connected to it in those particular interesting ways.
Well, speaking about that, what are moon children? Have you seen that show up in your charts?
I'm not sure I know the concept, to be perfectly honest with you. You have to forgive me because I really hang out and or slum, you know, over in the yogic sciences in the Tibetan grid. I actually probably more familiar with concepts in physics and physiology than I am more in the New Age thing. I can talk lavender children, like I at least know what it means, but or maybe it's violet children. I forget. But you might have to explain some concepts to me in context.
Well, moon children is just this concept that there were children that very much channel the moon and its energies, and that my daughter is very much like she wanted a telescope and she will just stare at the moon at night for long hours, and it's just I feel like she's communicating with it. So,
well, I mean, it's communicating with us realistically, and I mean that, like, you know, we. It is technically a dead, you know, sphere up in the sky, according to how we might define that. But its gravitational pull and execution on the planet has a considerable effect on us. And it is a very dramatic experience to watch it rise over the mountains, rise over a city. The closer it is in proximity to the surface and the horizon, the bigger it looks. It's an optical illusion, but it creates a tremendous effect among us. And I do think that we're all affected by the moon. I think it's impossible for us not to. So maybe basically what you're telling me is that your daughter is particularly, she has an affinity for it, right? And a deep connection to it and a fascination for it. And there are so many reasons that that might be the case. What's interesting is that in the system, the moon rules the left side of the brain, which is what I call the psychologic of the brain. Mm-hmm. And I call it psychologic because a lot of the logic that is in there is frankly just psycho. You know,
my daughter's a Gemini, so that makes sense.
Well, I mean, we form our psyches really by by the time we're 9 years old, and very much like the moon, the psyche is a magnetic principle. I like this, I don't like that. So it's all built in what I'm attracted to and what I'm repulsed by. Mm-hmm. And so much of that is engineered even in the preverbal states before we're even age 2 years old, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. What are the main differences between, and I know this is a loaded question, but between Western astrology and Vedic astrology, and why is it inherently more accurate?
Yeah, okay. I love you for that question. I mean, I'm gonna give you the asshole response. I'm gonna give you the asshole answer first, because that'll be fun and everybody can laugh at me and laugh whatever, period. But you know, the legitimacy about it is really that the Western system is bullshit and the Vedic system is not. And
yes.
but I will explain why my thinking is around that, and also like give the Western astrologers a little bit of a leg up. So we use in the Vedic system what's called the fixed star system, or the sidereal system. And I also like to call it the factual star system, just to piss Western astrologers off a little bit more. And what I mean by that is that when you go up into the night sky and you're looking for a planet, you will see, you know, for example, right now you will see Saturn, Mars, and Venus, and they are tightly conjunct inside of the Capricorn circuitry. Right. And you meaning you'll actually see the Capricorn constellation behind these planets with the naked eye. Now, in Western astrology, they will tell you that it is in the Aquarius circuitry. And they do this because they're not factoring in that the Earth has a wobble. And it's been moving off of the pole star for a considerable amount of time. This creates something that we call the precession of the equinoxes. So we presently, our North Pole is pointed towards a very early star in a very early degree of Pisces, but it is going to move and move us towards the Aquarius circuitry, very probably in the next 400 to 450 years, depending on earthquake activity. So Western astrologers, what they did in the 12th century was they fixed the first day of spring to the first day of Aries, and they left it there. And Vedic does not do that. Like the yogic system, we calculate the actual, or like I say, the factual star system. And so most everyone's planets are 23 degrees off, in the sense that if you have your sun in early degrees Cancer, then it's probably still going to be Cancer in that conversation. But if it's late degrees Cancer, then in my world, you're more likely going to be a Gemini. Or did I do that right? Yeah. Yes, everything goes back. So yes, early degrees Cancer, you're going to be early degree Cancer sun is going to give you a Cancer sun. But if you start going later degree, I think I'm screwing this all up. I am, actually. Yeah, because everything goes back. So late degree Gemini is going to Western astrologers are going to tell you that you're a Cancer. And that's not necessarily true in our world.
Yeah.
You know, it can be a real shock. Like I'm said to be a double Scorpio in the Western system. But then when it was explained to me that I was a Libra, everything made so much more sense to me, to be honest with you. Particularly, even in the Western system, like Libra is very different. We don't call it the scales of justice. In fact, justice really to a large degree in the scales of justice is an invention of the 18th to 19th century, really. It's the scales of the marketplace. And Libra is associated with the respiratory system, which is the breathing apparatus, right? And so the carbon molecule is the scale, and then O1 and O2 is what's measured across that. So Libra is all about reciprocity. It's all about commerce. It's all about kind of the lingua franca accordingly. And you see, and you will see a lot of artists here as well in context, because art requires an audience, right? There's reciprocity in that exchange where you need, you know, it's that whole thing. If a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, doesn't make a noise. It's the same thing with art. If you don't have someone to like look at your art, appreciate your art, listen to your art, are you really an artist? Oh. This is an interesting conversation in the process of it.
So in Vedic astrology, you could have an entirely different chart than you have in Western astrology.
Completely. And I do have clients that, you know, we have to spend the first 10 minutes, like, just kind of holding their hand through the shock of what do you mean I'm not a Scorpio?
Oh my gosh. let's get into some of the things that you see, coming for not just the US or, you know, but for Earth as a whole. So let's just kind of lead into what you see coming, like what we have to look forward to in the next year.
Okay. So, I mean, it's a really good question. And I think it's the kind of question that you would ask an astrologist. I mean, realistically, we have a map of probabilities. I think this is the thing that a lot of people get wrong, is that they think that I am some kind of fortune teller or super psychic who is, you know, literally has an access map to the Akashic records. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I would say is, even though we've really proved in quantum science that, you know, basically past, present, and future is occurring simultaneously, there is still an element of probability that's engaged, mm-hmm. right? And probability becomes very specific to our species because we are choice makers. Mm-hmm. You know, we are not working so much from just instinct, which is more animal, and the reptilian cortex, but we really do have an intellectual framework in our brain that allows us to make decisions and choices, right? And informed choices accordingly. And it's interesting because Mars is always called the war planet, but in a lot of ways, Mars is the action planet. It's the choice planet. Mm-hmm. And depending on what it's in conversation with, will really kind of lean us in for different types of preferences in our choices. There are people who are more passionate in their choices, which would be Venus and Mars conjunction. There are people that are more intellectual and strategic, which would be Mercury and the Mars accordingly, right? And the list goes on and on. And I think what's very important to understand is where I think Mars has become the planet of war is that any choice we make is a bit of an assault or an attack on the system, right? Because the system will have to respond to our choice. And even inaction is an action, right? You hear a woman being attacked in the park late at night next to your house and you do nothing about it, you know, realistically, that has a consequence versus if you do something about it. And this can affect tremendously, right? This is the whole idea of the butterfly effect. The butterfly effect meaning that, you know, do the wings of a butterfly's pattern, you know, in South Africa affect like the wind system in the rest of the world? And it's something called interdependence. And I think that all I'm really arguing for here is what I call interdependence at a macrobiological level, meaning that because we're on a biosphere that completely and thoroughly supports our life through, you know, plants as food and breath and water, that we would have to take off world if we were going to leave and travel in a spaceship, that in the conversation of that, our biosphere lives are somehow linked to the planet, which is helping engineer this through gravity and electromagnetism and the neurology of the sun, which I like to call it. Mm-hmm. So that's a long way of basically getting to this point, because I think this really is important to understand. Human beings are at a very huge pivot point. Like, we have really never been here before. Not in this lifetime, anyway. And we are 8 billion strong, which is a huge force. We, to a large degree, have moved off of an indigenous relationship with our biosphere. We are taking from her and not thinking about giving back, which is what really is meant in the indigenous format, right? Where you take from the earth, but you also give back to the earth. At this point, you know, I look at oil as we're mosquitoes, we're behaving as mosquitoes, and we're sucking some of the life blood and life warmth out of the mother and pumping it into her lungs accordingly, and really not thinking about what that means in context of our her survival. And people will say to me that they are so concerned about Mother Earth. And I'm like, you shouldn't be concerned about Mother Earth. She will take care of herself.
concerned about
you should be concerned about humanity in context, and you should understand what that technically means. We've created plastic islands at this point, so no life will grow on these plastic islands, but God knows they're running around and ramming things in the ocean at this point. So I think what's arrived, and I can really put my finger on it because it's such an interesting phenomenon, that in 2020, around Christmas time, Jupiter and Saturn conjunct, and they conjunct every 20 years and they reset the clock. And there's a beautiful book written by a woman, forgetting the name of it. She's a student of Chakrapani's, actually, Edith, someone. I'll find it for your list. And she basically was mapping how these 20-year cycles of Jupiter and Saturn reconnecting reset the clock for 20 years. And sometimes it'll reset the clock for 40 years, and sometimes it'll reset it for even longer. I think it's very reasonable, given what was going on in 1981 when it reset in the Virgo system. It was a pretty big reset. It birthed the internet, it birthed the home computer, like IBM really came online in an interesting way. And we were on a fast track towards this next big pivot. So Jupiter and Saturn conjuncts in the Capricorn circuitry, and Capricorn is associated with the detox mechanism. And it triggers a pandemic. And interestingly enough, more importantly, it triggers a detox of European colonialism, because it actually, what it did was it conjuncted on the winter solstice. And the last time this happened was over 800 years ago. And if we go back into 800 years of history, we basically are looking at the cradle of Europe beginning its engineering for European colonialism. And this is a very substantial thing to understand, because Europe advanced in large part because it was one of the most desirable real estates in the world at the time. And so many, many tribes went to war over it. And in order to get better at killing and dominating, you needed advancements in technology along the lines of weaponry and shipbuilding and navigation systems, which is what they perfected. So by the time that these European colonialists arrived on the shores of Africa and India and China, their basic attitude was, what? You don't have gunpowder? What? You don't have bullets? We must be superior to you because we can kill you. Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't take into effect or understanding the extraordinary martial arts and medicines of China, or the amazing yogic sciences in India. My guru can literally stop and restart his heart at will. It did not take into effect that the Maasai tribe has the ability to spot a snake, you know, a mile and a half away, just based on the way that sand patterns are flowing into the sky on the horizon. Like, these are extraordinary skill sets of indigenous peoples. But instead, we decided that killing was the dominant and important feature. And as a result, domination and world domination happened. What's happened now since then is, and I do always think that all these weird things are fulfilling their purposes. I think European colonialism has fulfilled its purpose in that it has suddenly united us, right? Because competition and domination through competition is what's engineered technology. And then in the process of engineering technology, we have globalized the world. I mean, I'm in New Mexico, you're in Los Angeles, and we're having this extraordinary conversation over video, which, by the way, every movie, sci-fi movie of the last like 50 years has been telling us we're headed this direction, but here we actually are now, right? So we can be in awe of this warrior mentality, but we've now arrived at a place where we need to move into something different, right? And I really have to give my guru credit for this theory, is that we're really heading towards commerce now, and we're moving into a space age, and we're looking for common language, we're looking for common digital experiences, which is why the zero and one was the easiest thing to create that in the generation of technology and computer. And I'll tell you something else. We've created a second astral plane alongside the world in the realm of the internet, right? Because you are now seeing, you know, QAnon is an entity. Like, let's just show up for what it is. It really is a viral internet infection, you know, that is able to plague people's thinking mechanism accordingly and engineer a cult without them ever having to go, you know, meet a guru or, you know, give money to a snake oil salesman. All they have to do is get on their Google and go down the rabbit hole of QAnon. And if they choose to believe it and opt into the mythology of it, then you've got a whole nother type of being that in a lot of ways is an internet astral invention, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And that's mind blowing. I hadn't thought of it that way. Like that's brilliant, brilliant way to explain it. Yeah.
So, you know, I think that where we're going is actually really exciting. I've never been more optimistic about the human race. That said, we got a lot of pivot to cover here in a very short amount of time as human beings. We all have whiplash. Like every century begins with inciting incidents. This is the first time that a century has begun with a global inciting incident. What I mean by that is for Europe, In the 19th century or the 20th century, we would have called it like probably World War I, whereas in America, it was probably more the crash of the stock market. But this began with COVID, which I like to say is COVID was the curtains up, you know, or it was the orchestra for the curtains up, really. And then I think the first act really begins now with the Ukrainian war, unfortunately, which is basically a test of wills between autocracy and democracy. And, you know, it's abundantly clear to me that democracy will win. It's just a question of how much damage is going to be wrought in the conversation of that, unfortunately. And we're seeing it everywhere. You know, when people get afraid, they lean in for strongmen to protect them, right? And this is pretty normal. Mm-hmm. And I think that functionally, it's a question of whether we can help people understand that one of the reasons that Russia is not doing so well is that realistically, autocracy doesn't ultimately engineer innovation mm-hmm. and personal pride and personal sense of duty, purpose, actually. And so they have far less incentive because they know that their system is rigged. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I've seen that's been a little sad in the process of America is to just watch a lot of the millennial mindset really feel that the system is rigged against it, which there is some truth to that, but there's still a lot of opportunity to engineer yourself out of that as well. Very, very different than living in Russia. And I know this because many of my guru's disciples are Russian and Ukrainian. So this is hitting our ashram, if to call it that, it probably isn't, but it is hitting the core group of people around my guru very substantially. And the conversations are quite interesting now.
How do you think that's going to shake out, you know, with Putin? And I mean, our leader is not very sane himself. So, you know,
I mean, I'm going to disagree with you on that one. Sure. I think I'm definitely going to disagree with you on that. I'm really, and that's one of the millennial fallacies that I'm really very frustrated with. You know, it's functionally one of the things that they have proven now through brain science is the older that you get, the more elastic your problem solving neurology actually is. Okay. And we have really arrived at a level of ageism that's going on. I think this is happening in large part because the boomer generation has really in some ways stolen a lot of opportunities from the millennial generation accordingly. And the millennial generation is understandably angry about that with good reason. But I also think the millennial generation to a large extent was very coddled by their boomer parents. And so there's some of that problem going on. Biden's chart is really solid. I mean, it is an extraordinary chart. I was not, you know, it's interesting. I wasn't focused on him at all. I was focused on Kamala, who had the happiest chart on election night. And then she was the first one to drop out. So I was really gobsmacked. And I thought, well, I'm not good at this, apparently. And then I was paid by some Wall Street guys to read Biden's chart when he won South Carolina. And there was no question he was going to win. It was just an airtight chart in a way that I even think you could have argued for or against Hillary. And there's another woman, she's a lovely person, a Vedic astrologer. I think she calls herself Eve of Astrology, lovely woman. And she got Trump right, and I did not. And it was very interesting around the Trump-Hillary thing, because if we had voted a day later, the moon had broke something called a Kaul Sarpa Yoga, which was favoring Trump. And if we had voted on Wednesday, I think it's highly unlikely that Trump would have won. But we voted on a Tuesday inside of it. And I'll tell you what's going to be crazy about midterms is we are voting on a lunar eclipse that day.
It's going to be very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. It's going to be very, very interesting, because what happens in a lunar eclipse is people are relegated to their reptilian kind of cortex fear systems. And we just don't really, it's going to be really hard to assess that. That said, and I keep going back to it, going, how am I seeing this? How am I seeing this? How is it possible? But, you know, Biden seems to be pretty happy on midterms night, which is very interesting to me. So I don't know. But I do see that you've got a lot of Putin apologists in the Republican Party. So that's one way it could tip in favor of Biden. I think the other thing that is really going on in the process functionally is that if Roe v. Wade is destroyed or even somewhat dismantled by the Supreme Court in June, I think you're going to see a lot of women come out to vote and not in favor of the Republican Party. You know, so there's still probabilities to account for and assess. Going back to Biden, I think it's important to understand that this is a man who stutters. Yeah. Very important. And he has his whole life, by the way. This is also a guy who he's a very high empath. Even in the chart, he's a very high empath, which will lead people into emotional blunders in conversation accordingly.
That makes more sense now you saying that. Okay. I didn't know that. So.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand that. He is a big stellium in the Libra heart circuitry, actually. And I mean, he was just an absolute lock. I mean, as soon as I saw the chart, I was like, and I hadn't even looked at it. And then when he won South Carolina and these guys paid me to look at the chart, I was like, oh, there's no question. I mean, there's just no question. Plus, Trump was really angry on election night. Like, it was just, he had Mars in the eighth house, which is the house of depth psychology. And he was just a tortured soul on election night. It was not good. And by the way, his chart doesn't look good for 2024 either. Not at all. I'll be surprised if he's running, actually.
What about Putin's? I mean, we kind of briefly discussed this last week, but
yeah, Putin's interesting. I mean, I know it puts a target on my back. I'm kidding, but I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think that Putin has undergone is having some kind of assault on his neurological system that was triggered in 2017 to 2019. He has a Saturn Sun conjunction. It puts a tremendous strain on the neurological system and can make people very vulnerable to things like Parkinson's or just different types of neurological disorders.
Cause them to be impulsive or something like that and do something careless
Not so much that, because he really has been a master chess player up until now. He's wildly miscalculated this one. It's a shame, because there's a whole nation of lovely human beings that, you know, are not Putin, and we should be very careful not to demonize the Russian people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, but they are definitely being dragged down in his narcissism. And that's also on the table as well, is that he has Venus supposedly conjunct his ascendant, if the birth time I have is correct. It seems to be. And a lot of times Venus conjunct in ascendant, particularly when it's super strong, will engineer narcissism. And Saturn is throwing its gaze on that. And I think he really believes he's one of the great conquerors you know, in the tradition of Ivan the Terrible and Catherine the Great, right? Peter the Great. And I think this delusion is actually what's sent him into this misadventure. And there is a window that I don't mind saying. There is a window at the end of March through the beginning, early beginning of April, where we could all get a humility inflection point that could hopefully engineer something like a ceasefire and terms. But this one's going to be gnarly, I think. It's heartbreaking to watch because, like I say, I have friends and
So do I.
They're good Russians. Yeah. And Zelensky has just been incredible. I mean, it's just talk about rising to the occasion. I just think everywhere in the mix of it. And it's so strange to hear him being called a Nazi when, you know, his family died in the Holocaust, no less. But this is what tyrants do, right? Like they engineer and they weaponize basically their own behavior, and they take their own bad behavior and accuse other people of it. And it's a very, very effective way of autocracy. But I just don't think in the end, autocracy is the future. I think democracy is the future, and we're slowly finding our way towards that.
What about cataclysmic events in the next year?
God, you're looking for all the shitty stuff, aren't you?
Well, no, I want people to be prepared.
No, then listen.
At the end, then I want you to give the good news.
No, listen, I love you for asking the tough questions that are on people's minds. And, you know, I'm not going to sound prescient. I probably even sound like a charlatan, but I'll tell you what I am looking at. Is that we still haven't got the memo on oil. You know, we still haven't, we're getting it. I mean, the war is definitely helping us get it. Mm-hmm. I really think that's one of the most fascinating things, is that I thought it was going to be a climate change event that really, you know, sent the world leaders the memo that you've got to move on oil immediately. But it's this Crimean war, interestingly enough, from, you know, and the only thing that's propping Russia up is their oil reserves. And what a lot of people don't understand is the Crimean Peninsula, right? And all of that ocean they believe that it has the third or fourth largest oil reserves in the world. So here's this antiquity out of the Cold War in autocratic fashion, imagining that he just needs to get more oil, even though he's not paying attention to why we stay on oil. Doesn't make sense, because climate change is very real. I mean, the less than 2% of scientists across the world can agree on this. And so I just think that it's important for us to understand that we are in process of getting the memo, right? And we can't be having this conversation of like, oh, we're going to be off oil by 2050. Too late. Way too late. And the truth is, we have the technologies to go faster. You have tremendous, tremendous pushback from the bottom line oil companies who have enormous control on world governments across the world, because the truth is, we still need oil to engineer this shift. And if we could figure out how to enroll these corporate leaders to get on the side of new development and new technology, where they probably should have been 20 or 30 years ago, to be honest with you, right? Mm-hmm. That then, you know, we all win, realistically. We all win. But it's convincing human beings away from, weirdly enough, their scarcity mentality. And I just genuinely believe that all greed and poverty consciousness comes from scarcity mentality. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. I don't have enough.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the world who have misunderstood what money is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where we're sitting here, is can we reteach that? Because the truth is all money really is gratitude. That's all it is, really.
Yeah.
It's like if I have a service and you want my service and I do a good job with my service, you don't have a problem paying me the money that I'm asking you to pay me. Mm-hmm. We've both arrived at an agreement of terms accordingly, right? It's reciprocity.
Right. Yeah.
It's breathing apparatus, right? This is why I think breath work is so important for everyone right now, mm-hmm. to be deeply engaged in breath work, which is also why COVID is a respiratory illness.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
It's actually a blood disease, but it's transferred through an aerosol. You know? So I think that's an interesting piece of the conversation as well. And the planets talk about that. Like when Saturn is in the Capricorn circuitry, he throws his gaze 10 directions onto the Libra circuitry, which is the respiratory system accordingly. We can look at probabilities and we can assess your life as skill sets and context. And that context can be genetic context, historical context, national context. Eventually, we're heading towards corporate context, right? Because I said to a CEO the other day, I said, we're looking at the rise of technocracies, right? Because I think the future is getting to an indigenous relationship with planet Earth and the rise of technology. That's what we're looking at coming together, right? And those indigenous sciences include yoga and Taoism and a lot of the places that you work with in these, you know, intuitive arts accordingly, because listen, scientists are intuitive. Mm-hmm. How do you think they engineer a lot of their extraordinary breakthroughs? Is they let their mind go away and they trust that it is ordering things while they're distracting themselves. And then suddenly, you know, like the guys who discovered the double helix, they were just, one of them, I think, was walking up and or down the spiral staircase. And then that's how it hit him in context, right? You ask the questions long enough and you will arrive at some very interesting answers. And some of it will be things that you can verify as fact.
And do you think that the financial system will be able to sort of collapse it and start over? Do you think that that's possible?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure it needs to collapse, actually. Like that's the interesting thing about it, right? I'm going to be a super villain on your show. You're going to hate me, but it's all good. We're going to go there. Like, I'm really excited that they're starting to that they're starting to regulate Bitcoin, because I am concerned about what can potentially be happening to people in Bitcoin. I'm seeing people get ripped off in Bitcoin. I'm seeing, you know, I think it's very hard to argue that Bitcoin, you know, or Tesla coin or whatever the hell it is going to suddenly just overtake, you know, a multi-centuries old banking system, right? Now, granted, Nixon took us off the gold standard and we're all off the gold standard at this point, but there still is an electronic system in place and it, to a large extent, is functioning. So the question really becomes, how do we arrive at bridging these two things and making them all work together? I don't think one has to kill the other. Mm-hmm. I think that they have to figure these things out. And it's hard to imagine, like, you know, a banking industry without futures per se.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's a corrupt system in my eyes. And so, I mean, I guess I'd like to see, you know, something different happen that is inclusive of everybody and that is makes it easier for goods and services to be traded, not just, you know, one large.
Well, you're seeing some of that, like, you know, and I really mean that. Like, look at Venmo, look at PayPal. Okay. These are quite extraordinary, actually. You know, look at Etsy. Mm-hmm. I think that look at the way music has technically changed. You know, I actually have a lot of musicians as clients, and you know, they predominantly make their money on tour now. But at the same time, you can really find like all types of different music that you couldn't find, because particularly in America, it was dominated by Clear Channel. And specifically, just one woman at the top of Clear Channel was basically deciding what got played and what didn't get played. At the longest time on American radio, it was a form of absolutely commercial music autocracy, and it came toppling down with digital. And I think that we're seeing that in the entertainment realm as well. Now, the hardest part about me sitting down in front of the TV is literally figuring out what I want to watch, given all the plethora of options that I technically have now. Mm. And so I think that money will find its way there as well. And I think that digital communities will create their own lingua franca in context of that accordingly. And, you know, you're even starting to see that in the permaculture world and the permaculture building and these kinds of things. I think to go back to your original question about the climate disaster, I think we haven't seen anything yet, to be honest with you. And I am afraid, just based on what I'm looking at the charts, and I hope that I'm really wrong, but because we are in such an innovation period in 23, 24, 25, and maybe the Ukraine war is the thing that engineers this faster, I still think we have a climate disaster coming this year, the likes of which we can barely put our head around, to be honest with you. I mean, like something just next level. And I think people have to be very clear that, as I said to a client the other day who was very interested in just kind of moving to New Zealand, is I was like, where are you going to run?
New Zealand isn't any better.
No, I mean, New Zealand, like there's volcanic activity that's shaking up now. They had one of the largest earthquakes in the Ring of Fire over the last 2 years, you know, that really, really fucked with Auckland in a really big way. There's nowhere you're going to run. Like we're all the center man in this one. You know, we've all the times that we are consuming, you know, water out of plastic bottles, you know, you're contributing, and we're going to have to start showing up for these conversations now, and nobody wants them. But I will tell you this.
People are complacent. They don't want to, it's like they're too lazy to change things. And it's,
well, I'll tell you what my theory is, that it's a very good point, and I don't disagree with you. I think what's happened, and this is where I want to give the human race, like, you know, some cushion and some love, is that, you know, roughly from about 1946, after World War II, which began to rebuild Europe and the United States, you know, from about 1940, let's call it 48, to roughly around 1980, at the advent of Reagan, God help us, we were literally engineering a leisure society. And by the time 80 hit and Reagan came online with the idea of business over citizenry, which is really what his policy was, and, you know, capitalism over actual human beings. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I think he was very leaned in for was deregulation.
And the whole drug scare of,
that was a war on poverty, basically, and people who were poor. And then trickle down economics, the idea that the rich would trickle it down, which is ridiculous.
Right.
And there's a quote from Herbert Hoover, who was one of the, you know, presided over the crash of Wall Street. It's a great quote where he says, there's only one thing wrong with capitalism, capitalist. They're too damn greedy. And so this basically engineered a 40, you know, very long period in American politics. It we saw the birth of Thatcherism in England as a result of it as well. And these were the two big hubs of the commercial markets. And so we leaned in basically creating this dominant oligarchical wealth class. And we need to be very mindful that that is what has happened. We're creating 50 billionaires a year plus in the United States now. That's a lot of fingers on the Wall Street, you know, like market, realistically.
And we still have homelessness, which is like, I mean, that's just that kind of stuff just drives
me. Well, Homelessness is going to get worse because we're looking at we're looking at a refugee future in every quarter from both war angle and also the wars over water, and then really the climate change disaster. I think anyone living on the coast can and should be prepared to have to move inward. I think that's unfortunate, but I think it's a fair point. And going back to this for a minute, just on the commerce front, I see a world where we can come together. And I'm going to give you two very interesting examples just in the last year and a half. And I don't care whether you're vax or anti-vax. It doesn't matter to me. I'm not in that boat. I just don't, like, it's a personal decision. Figure it out for yourself.
Yeah.
But this is the thing. The entire scientific community and the entire corporate community and most nation states came to the table to share information across the world to engineer these vaccines. Mm-hmm. Whether you believe they work or not, doesn't matter. Like, they came together to share information, never been done before across the world. Mm-hmm. The next thing that I think is extraordinary is if you really look at the sanctions on Russia are like nothing we have ever seen before, not even with North Korea. It's mind-blowing. And that it's not just been nation states, Western nation states predominantly, not Africa, not the South America, but that it is also realistically corporations. McDonald's pulling out and Starbucks pulling out. And I think that this is a sign to me that human beings are starting to understand that we're going to need to work together.
Yeah.
And we have a history of that. If you look at New Yorkers in 9/11, I mean, come on, look at New Yorkers in 9/11. Yay! Look at these people.
Yeah.
And look, they're engineered towards that because they're already living in a melting pot in a very, very big way. But I think that's a map of where we're ultimately going to need to get to. And I think it's going to be easy. And I think it's not going to be easy. And I think people are going to fight it. And I think it's very important. There's a wonderful podcast coming out of LA called Life Examined. Mm-hmm. I quite like a lot of his episodes. And he had one this week on xenophobia, mm-hmm. and really understanding why people like to hate and yeah. need to hate.
Yeah.
And it's very helpful for us to be kind of exploring this so that we're understanding our fellow human beings. And when we're encountering racism, when we're encountering misogyny and homophobia, anti-Semitism, we can really understand that we're dealing with a subpar intelligence and a subpar psychology. And maybe there's a way for us to help engineer them to a smarter place, right? It's like a friend of mine. She and I like to call ourselves weapons of mass instruction.
I love that.
And that's just really it. I think it is time to be a weapon, but I think the question is, what are you being a weapon for? It's like, I would rather be a weapon for the guardianship and the custodianship of planet Earth mm-hmm. than be a weapon for a nation state or, you know, and by the way, I was going to say this. So I said to this CEO, you know, that we're looking at the rise of technocracies. And he was like, whoa, 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 hold on, Norse. Like, explain that to me. And I said, okay, well, I mean, if you held a gun to my head, and I do love a lot of things about America, but if you held a gun to my head and made me choose between Apple and America, I'd probably have to go with Apple because my life is on Apple and I would be moving to Portugal, right? Because, you know, it's just like, I love America. It's great. But mm-hmm. I also think that Apple is extraordinary. And then, but then when you realize that Apple has really dug themselves into a little bit of the ditch by being so based in China, yeah. oh shit, which is an autocratic government, which eventually that's going to come due. So if I was, you know, a $3 trillion company like Apple, I would be figuring out how to take a trillion of that to move myself out of China immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
So what I ask this of every one of my guests that come on, what is your, if you could just like give one message to humanity, what is your message?
Oh, that's beautiful. Can I answer a little bit of a different way?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. So I used to have this thing that I played with myself when I was a kid, that if aliens came down and asked me, you know, how they could best help us, what would I tell them? And I still kind of play this now.
I love that.
It's stop greed. Please understand when you're in scarcity mentality. And you're in scarcity mentality when you're imagining that you're poor and you don't have options. And you're in scarcity mentality when you're imagining that you can never have enough. And so you have to fuck this person and get that money and, you know, land this deal. And it's like, please, 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 let's start rethinking what exchange is about. Like, you know, we need to be in gratitude. Gratitude is really a superpower, to quote an old friend of mine. And if we can be in gratitude and not in greed, like, everything changes.
I agree. Yeah. That's really beautiful. Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Thank you for asking the question. It's a good question. Well, I really do every day wake up and give myself the gift of a few moments of being really, really grateful.
I do too. Yeah, I think it's important. And that's something we need to teach our kids as well. Like, you know, we sit down and we do the same thing in the evening and, you know, and when she wakes up to go to school. So,
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because that would be my other thing is that I think that the future of civilization begins with early education, and education should not be regurgitation of facts or stats. It really needs to be teach them problem solving skills, teach them empathy, teach them self-esteem and personal encouragement. And teach them meditation.
Yeah.
Teach them to be best friends with their imagination. You know, introduce their breath to them. You know, help them understand what foods make them feel good and what foods don't make them feel good. You know, teach them to play and be inventive, but also teach them responsibility. Teach them duty. Give them some structure. Give them some discipline. Let them understand. You know, don't punish them, but inform them of why their behavior is actually not the thing that's going to help them ultimately in their life as little adults and then real adults. Like, that would be the best thing we could do as human beings right now, is really...
Kids are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. And really, that needs to be addressed, because you're right. We don't sit down and explain why this isn't a good idea to do these things and show them how, you know, it can have consequences. Instead, we just say, no, don't do it, you know, just or stop. And
I think if we enroll them as little adults, but also give them lots of room to be their playful little selves as well, then we have done them a very extraordinary service. And I do think you're right. And you're a mother. You know, and I think motherhood creates almost the seventh sense, because you, for whatever is happening, you are a portal for a life and an intelligence and a soul that's going to navigate the world accordingly. And wherever that soul came from, you have been that portal. And there is a telepathic connection between the two of you if you will show up for that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of mothers now really want to. That's the other thing I would say, which is a very hard thing to say, but I am, I really hope that we move out of this space quickly where we're forcing women to choose between careers and babies and find a way. I mean, 9 to 5, the movie talked about this, for Christ's sakes, and we're still not at this place where CEOs are understanding that mothers are the only multitasker in the world. And, yeah, I mean, what are we doing? How are you not harnessing all of that energy in the best ways?
It's funny, in Germany, when I lived there, they have a much better system for this. And they also have a better work-life balance. Like, when they get off work at 5 o'clock, if you write them an email, it's like, what are you doing? Like, I'm off. Yeah. They would never think to stay late and things like that. They're like, what's wrong with you? It's you're home. And I loved it.
I love that you're saying that. Because, you know, that's the thing is that people are, they, like, socialism has become a very dirty word in America. But I think that's only because Democrats aren't showing up to explain what social democracy is, which is what Europe is really structured on. And, you know, I know a lot of happy people in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of Europeans that love to come to America because they can make more money here. My question is, why are you making the money? Mm-hmm. That's always my question. Why are you making the money?
Yeah.
Money is gratitude. It's also freedom. It's also opportunity. And it's also leverage. It's in the area of leverage that we get really, really sketchy. Because if you're leveraging it for power over other people, if you're leveraging it for, you know, sexuality, if you're leveraging it for, you know, domination in a system accordingly, you really are missing out on an opportunity to be a more humane person. And I know that integrity is its own reward. I've learned that on my own. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have a lot of wealthy clients and I love them very much, but I would say many of them are some of my most unhappy clients.
Oh,
and
for sure.
And it's sad to see, because we've been told that money will make you the happiest, mm-hmm. right? And then these people have worked very hard, and I give them mad props for their efforts to then engineer that for themselves. But then they're not enjoying the fruits of their labors, because happiness doesn't come outside of ourselves. It really starts inside of ourselves, truly.
No, I'm glad you said that, because I mean, I've never been happier at this stage in my life, but I'm able to spend time with my daughter. I'm not working so hard that I can't do that and spend time with my family. And I love my clients. And I mean, I'm at this great place right now. And it's like, I wouldn't sacrifice any of that for more money.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And there's a balance, you know, there really is a balance. And it's funny, because I was talking to a very, very awake friend and client of mine the other day, and he was just so cool, because he said, you know, there's no way in my lifetime I could spend the money that I have. There's no way. And he said, so now I'm looking at new systems of helping lots of other people participate in new ways of thinking around money and development. And I do think there's enough down here. I just think we've got to be engineering it in a different way. And this refugee crisis, to be honest with you, is probably going to speed that along, realistically. Okay. I've been really impressed. Yeah. I mean, Elon Musk has showed up with Skylink for Ukraine. Like, it's just kind of amazing to see how but I think you can also, it's important to also just kind of say, well, you know, why didn't people show up for Syria this way? Why didn't people show up for Darfur this way? And I think that white people definitely have a responsibility to say, am I living inside of a privileged bubble that is not allowing me to really look at my fellow man as my exact and absolute fellow human? And, you know, how can I expand my education so that I'm not doing that? And I think that self-scrutiny is another huge part of the equation here.
Yeah. And I loved what you said earlier, because I'm taking this class on trauma response therapy, and how the teacher does is breaks us up into groups with white and then, you know, other races. And he switches them. So for us to kind of understand from a trauma-based perspective, how things start with race. And it's really, really interesting. And it's like we need to put ourselves in other people's shoes to understand what they've walked through. And, you know, I really think that that's kind of the beginning of the recalibration of humanity. And I think,
yeah, I love you for saying that. And that's why I also say, and I know I probably sound like a crazy person to some people, but like, that's why I say I really like Joe Biden, because he's an empath and you can really see the empathy in his approach, realistically. I mean, you know, people thought it was a political move to put a quote unquote black woman on the Supreme Court. Let's break that down for a minute. First of all, black mothers are the ones who mostly survive the war and that is going on in their communities. They are the group of women who, over a very long suspended or extended, battle, have formed these huge voting coalitions accordingly, and have really, really, they handpicked the candidate in South Carolina. That is a fact. And, you know, I don't think it's just because I've heard naysayers say that, you know, it's just because he was a vice president to a black man. I don't think that's true. I think these are very informed voters and very informed, thoughtful, you know, community leaders. And they are a matriarchal society because they've had to be. A lot of their men have been killed and incarcerated accordingly. And, you know, we can all learn from each other if we will just meet each other. That's just the fun of the world, actually, is getting out there and actually seeing a point of view that's outside of your own, because it will make you smarter. Yeah. And there are cool things. I don't know that I call it misappropriation, but there are cool cultural little things that I love to, like, you know, like, I mean, I cook with ghee every time now. Yeah. Like, I love ghee. It's great. well, I would have never thought about cooking with ghee, to be honest with you. What? Like, what? It's delicious.
Oh, yeah, I use ghee too. So, not all the time because my boyfriend has a whole issue with it, but you know.
Yeah, but I just think it's really great that, you know, I think the beauty of other cultures is to meet other cultures, because they will teach you a lot of wonderful things. And you did say something that I want to pick up on for a quick second before you kick me off, and you should kick me off soon, I'm sure. But
no, I have you on forever.
I know you're a lovely, you know, you're a lovely human. And the thing is, you brought up corruption, right? And I look, there's no question corruption exists in every system. And I think that where it comes from, just to borrow from AA, actually, this is one of their sayings. They say that hurt people hurt people.
That's true. Wow. Uh-huh.
You know, and it's just so simple, but I think it's so true. And it is, there are some societies that are more built around corruption than rule of law, and there are some societies that are built more around rule of law than corruption. And, you know, we've demonized people into Republicans and Democrats in this country. But I would just like to point out that there is no evidence whatsoever anywhere that Trump won the election and that there was any fraud or any real fraud that was affecting the election at that time. But it was Republicans in Republican states that actually handed that presidency to Biden, because they stood up for the rule of law over corruption. And I think that's something that we as a country can be very, very proud of at this moment and be very mindful of towards the future of our elections, because I'm sure there are corrupt people that are targeting those same election boards now in favor of hoping to, you know, engineer minority rule of law. But I think
Cheyenne and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, like, you know, people that murder and kill and things like that, like, how hurt must they be in order to have that? Like, how tough must their childhood have been where they had to do things like this? You know,
how backed into a corner, how destroyed is their esteem, you know? And that doesn't mean that we don't need to manage crime and corruption, because we do. Mm-hmm. It's just, we also need to understand it. You know, it can't just be a privatized prison system. Like, these people be rehabilitated? Yeah. Can these people be educated? Can we find the resources and the value to harness that human capital in the direction of the positive for all of us? And I think that's a question we all need to be asking ourselves now. And I do think that where there's a will, there's a way. That's one of the beautiful things about the United States, is what our freedoms have given us is the ability to engineer new ways and new thinking. And I don't think that's something that we should be ashamed of. What I think we should be mindful of is the ways that we don't help other countries show up to create that for themselves.
No, I would agree with that 100%. I'm glad you said some of these things, because it's really kind of shifted my thinking a little bit now that you kind of explained the thing with Biden and that he's an empath. That makes me totally look at him in a different context, right? And it makes me really see things from a different perspective. And I'm always open to that. So
of course, me too. And yeah. I'm always so open to the other thing as well. I feel like to a certain extent, I have a little bit of advantage because I can pop a chart and really climb up into the chart and look at it. Right. And in this podcast, we just finished recording it. And the last episode, I let them choose who they wanted me to read. But we looked at Princess Diana's chart.
Oh, wow.
And I had never been in the chart. I had never seen the chart. I certainly am. How can you not be aware of her? I cried several times reading the chart. I mean, she really is an extraordinary human being. She was an extraordinary human being. And I mean, so much more than even she probably understood. And to paint her as a psychologically damaged human being is to have missed the entire story of what she did. And she was like, the humanity in her chart was just mind blowing. I mean, just mind blowing. And I think that she re-engineered the British royalty towards this. And I think she had the most dominant hand in it. And that's abundantly clear in the chart. And I just walked away from it feeling like I had met a brand new friend that I didn't even know. And I would love to be able to give everybody the opportunity to look at a chart and not be judgmental, but be informed, right? And to be to meet someone and in a whole new way.
That's cool. What is this podcast you're doing? What is it called? Just so people can
We're know. Not out yet. We're not out yet. We've got I've got 42 hours to edit, so don't be pushy, goddammit.
Okay, sorry.
But no, I'm teasing you. But we will definitely drop it. I don't know how quickly we'll drop it. There's a biography of my guru that's coming out, and I'm very mindful of it, and I think it's one of the most extraordinary things that I've ever read. Really, it really changed my life. And I've read a lot of books on yogis, but this book really changed my life. It's written by an extraordinary and very talented Russian woman who is just one of the greatest writers I've ever read, particularly in this space. And so I want to be mindful of that kind of dropping first, because I really feel like, to a large degree, I'm his weapon of mass instruction at this point, so I'm going to follow his lead a little bit here.
What's the name of the biography that's coming out?
It's called The Awakener, and I'm not sure where they are in the publishing, but I'm expecting it to be out this year.
Okay.
And I have to tell you, like, I read the rough draft, and now I'm reading other parts of the new draft, and entire pages I'm having to stop my day and just really assimilate what I've learned just in one page. It's yeah. Mind blowing, you know, but I also really felt very strongly about Autobiography of a Yogi. That book really changed my life too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for coming on. It was amazing to have you on, and we'll definitely have to have you on again soon. So
it's such an honor and a privilege, and I really appreciate your love that you just keep pouring out to your community. I can just tell how heartfelt it really is, and I mean that. And I think that when people work from the heart, the best things happen, truly. So thank you both, and thank you, you know, thank you, Shay, the Fae.
Yeah, sorry I didn't talk much. I was like driving down the hill because my Wi-Fi wasn't working, and I was like,
you were there in laughter and spirit, and I wish you both the most beautiful day. I think you clearly have a beautiful friendship, and that's awesome.
Well, thank you so much. Like, yeah, this was a beautiful honor.
Have a great day.
Bye.